To the latest test, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol vowed to make Pyongyang pay for its, quote, reckless provocations. Yoon, who has been staging several joint military drills with the U.S. over the past year, says Seoul would develop its own nukes if deemed necessary. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Jennifer Chang, who's joining us from Seoul. Also, we have independent China specialist Andrew Loing, who's joining us from Hong Kong. Welcome to the program. To the both of you, let's start off with Jennifer. Please bring us up to speed on the escalated tensions on the Korean Peninsula right now.
Well, North Korea made its bombshell announcement today that from March 21st through March 23rd, it had conducted a successful test of a underwater drone that cruised along for over 59 hours. It was a drone that never surfaced, and then it exploded a mock nuclear warhead, creating a tsunami, a huge pillar of water, and this can destroy any South Korean port and any U.S. aircraft carrier. Now, there's a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, the USS Nimitz, coming here. It will be docked in Busan, which is the southeastern port of South Korea. That is practically the furthest point away from North Korea, but that will be no problem for North Korea to hit and destroy this USS aircraft carrier, which is loaded with stealth fighter jets. So this is a huge, huge threat to the U.S. and South Korea. And this aircraft carrier will take part in joint military drills with the South Koreans and with the Japanese. These will be naval drills. So this is going to put pressure on the U.S., South Korea, and Japan to come up with more than what they've been doing. They've been accelerating and intensifying their joint drills, but it's not doing any good. And at the same time, as North Korea held these drills, it also fired off four nuclear warhead cruise missiles. These flew 1,500 kilometers and 1,800 kilometers in an oval pattern and a figure eight pattern, and accurately hit their targets in the East Sea. So this means now that they can nuke South Korea with tactical nuclear weapons in many different areas. Throughout these Freedom Shield drills that have been going on between the U.S. and South Korea from March 13th to March 23rd, North Korea has been showing that it has a wide variety of nuclear delivery systems to South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. mainland, and the U.S. and South Korea and Japan have to watch out and not do so many military drills like they're doing, because North Korea is not going to back down.
Andrew Loing in Hong Kong, tensions, as we see, are continuing to rise on the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang claims to have tested a new tactical weapon, which is capable of creating a, quote, radioactive tsunami. Kim Jong-un said that the exercise was a warning to Washington and Seoul to be aware of the North's nuclear deterrence. Give us your perspective on the recent developments on the Korean Peninsula.
Well, as I have said on this channel so many times before, what North Korea doesn't want is to invade other countries all of a sudden. All these delivery systems is a reflex action against decades of hypocritical negotiations, so-called six-party talks, and previous President Donald Trump walking across the border trying to shake hands with Kim. All these are just rhetoric. At the end of the day, the United States wanted the North Koreans to surrender everything, nuclear defense, before they even talk about any concessions. And obviously, this is not going to be tolerated as far as the national security of North Korea is concerned. So now North Korea is developing this kind of dramatic underwater nuclear weapons. It's not only just to threaten American assets in South Korea, in the port of Busan or elsewhere. It's not just to threaten their naval bases in Guam or and also Okinawa, but also to deny access of aircraft carrier groups to the theater of war around North Korea. Just imagine that if we can just explode an underwater nuclear drone, the area, the nuclear power battle groups could easily be destroyed by a huge tsunami. So this is another anti-access aerial denial kind of weaponry in the arsenal, just pointed out with long-range cruise missiles and so on and so forth. So the whole thing centers on North Korea insurance policy against the hegemonic kind of imposition, trying to cause regime change on this false rhetoric of contest between democracy and authoritarianism. What Kim wants to do is really to build a security to safeguard his national security so as to be able to develop his economy. Because at the end of the day, economy could only bring about a better life for its people and to legitimize and to prolong the legitimacy of his regime. It's always the economy. But without security, it would be very difficult for North Korea to spend resources, because at the end of the day, at the drop of a hat, you can have an American-inspired invasion. It's just like Vietnam. Now, Vietnam is also a very important story, because at the end of the day, don't forget the Vietnam War, years of Vietnam War resulted in American retreat. But now Vietnam has become almost an American ally. Why is that? It's the economy, stupid. It's the economy. So I think that the North Korea, South Korea, and the United States in particular, are missing the trick. I mean, they're getting the wrong end of the stick and just focusing on the military, you know, trying to double down on everything without regard to the power of economic transformation. But that's the a very sad thing, because this is not just the reflection of the Americans' false kind of strategy. It informs the everywhere. I mean, against China, using the military over the, in the South China Sea, and now Russia over Ukraine, because everything to the Americans, everything is a nail, because all they've got is a hammer. But that's the part of the Americans' military the industrial complex, or I should say, right, military, industrial, financial complex.
All right, thanks a lot. Jennifer Chang joining us from Seoul, and Independent China Specialist Andrew Loing joining us from Hong Kong. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of Newsroom. You stick around, there's plenty more to come. Moving on, Iran has strongly condemned Israel's attacks against the international airport in the Syrian city of Aleppo. The country's deputy ambassador to the United Nations says such attacks pose a serious threat to the regional peace and stability. Zahra Ershadi was addressing a UN Security Council session on the situation in Syria. She said Israel's attacks target Syria's civilian infrastructure and violate international humanitarian law and the UN Charter. Ershadi added that Israel's strikes have serious humanitarian consequences for the people of Aleppo following the recent devastating earthquake that hit northwestern parts of Syria. The Iranian diplomat called on the international community to end its silence and hold Israel to account for its crimes. She also urged the UN Security Council to stop its double standard approach to Israel and condemn the regime's violations of international law and the UN Charter. Israel has conducted two major strikes, airstrikes, that is, against the Aleppo International Airport. In less than a month, the airport is the main port of entry for for foreign aid to quake victims. Well, U.S. space in northeastern Syria has come under a missile attack hours after Washington announced that it targeted resistance groups in the area. The base is located at the Al Omar oil field in Deir al-Zawr province. No group has taken responsibility, but a military source in Syria earlier told Press TV that a decisive action would be taken in response to the U.S. air raid. On Thursday, a U.S. base near Hasaka also came under attack by an unmanned aircraft, leaving a U.S. contractor dead and five U.S. servicemen injured. Washington has stationed hundreds of troops in Syria under the guise that they're fighting terrorist groups like Daesh. The Syrian government, however, sees the troops as occupiers. Damascus says U.S. military presence on the country's soil violates its sovereignty and is aimed at looting its natural resources. Tensions between Beijing and Washington are reaching fever pitch over a U.S. warship that has sailed through the South China Sea. Beijing says it has once again driven away the U.S. Navy-guided missile destroyer that had illegally entered its territorial waters. Beijing warned Washington to immediately stop what it calls such provocative acts. China said the U.S. will face serious consequences if it brushes aside the stern warning. The U.S. Navy said its warship was asserting its navigational rights and freedoms. It was for the second day in a row that Beijing drove away the U.S. Navy destroyer from waters around the Paracel Islands. China claims vast swaths of the South China Sea, but sovereignty over the area is a major source of contention between Beijing and Washington. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
God's Month. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. This year, the spring of nature has coincided with the spring of Quran, the blessed month of Ramadan. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, three times are the time of answering of prayer. After every ritual obligatory prayer, at the time of raining, and when God shows one of his signs to his servants. Sign is something which shows the way and guides us to a goal. So, anything that shows us the greatness and glory of God is his sign. Is there a sign clearer than Ramadan? God has chosen this month, among his times, to send down his last book and to speak to his servants. Is there a juncture better than this for praying and supplication? With the start of the blessed month of Ramadan, the gates of heavens are open and the rain of divine mercy falls on the faithful. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, prayer is the key to the divine mercy and the light in darkness. Let us take the opportunity and from the very first day of Ramadan appeal to God to remove darkness from our hearts. As long as darkness dominates the heart, there won't be a room for God's mercy and forgiveness. But everything has its special manners. The first manner for praying is to be clean. Thus, it has been emphasized to perform ritual ablution before praying. Imam Ali, peace upon him, has also said, "Whenever there is a great and hard work, perform ritual ablution and then raise your hands for prayer." The second manner for prayer is to start it in the name of Allah. It has been narrated from the Prophet of Islam that he said, "When a servant says, 'Bismillahirrahmanirrahim,' God the Exalted says, 'My servant started in my name, so it is upon me to accomplish his affairs and bless him in every state.'" The third manner for prayer is to praise God. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "The demand which is not preceded by God's praise will not end anywhere." These manners have been observed by Prophet Muhammad and the infallible imams of his progeny, blessings of God upon them. The ulama throughout history have also observed these manners. Dua means prayer and supplication in Arabic. Dua Abu Hamza Somali, Dua Sahar, and the daily dua for each day of the blessed month of Ramadan are among the prayers and supplications which are highly recommended to recite in this month. All of these prayers contain beautiful and profound points. Another famous supplication in this month is Dua Iftitah, which contains lofty concepts, and according to a narration, the Imam of the Age, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, had taught it to his second special representative, Muhammad bin Usman, and the latter published it for all believers. Dua Iftitah is recited in the nights of this blessed month. Like many other supplications, it begins with praising God. It begins in this way: "O Allah, indeed I start eulogy with your praise, while you have had favor on me to guide me toward correctness and piety." In this part of the supplication, the servant's ability to praise God has been considered as a success and help from Allah. In fact, from the very beginning, the servant admits that any praise begins with praising God, and this praise stems from his attention to his servants. Were there not God's favor, nobody could praise him. Therefore, whatever anyone has is granted by God. Any perfection that we have attained has been accomplished with God's permission. Whatever righteous deed that we do is a favor from God. The next part of Iftitah supplication reads, "I know it with certainty that you are the most merciful of the merciful in the position of pardoning and mercy, and the harshest of punishers in the position of punishment, and the greatest of rulers in the position of majesty and greatness." Here the servant says that whenever he calls God, he is filled with certainty. He is sure that God's mercy is above all the merciful in the world. On one hand, when he demonstrates his love, it surpasses the love of a mother. On the other hand, if he is to punish someone, he is the most severe one. Dear friends, the righteous can never be placed with the evildoers. God has promised that these two groups are not the same. So, how will be the fate of the oppressors and arrogant rulers of the past, like the Pharaoh and Nimrod, and the devilish persons of the modern world, like the US and Israeli criminals, whose only function is to mass murder innocent people everywhere in the world? God's justice will surely determine the harshest punishment for such people.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Tying the knot may not be as easy as some might think in the United States. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 1 in 4 Americans have some sort of physical disability, and for those who receive federal benefits, marriage may not be a good idea. The cost of living and healthcare for the disabled in America is extremely high, and those who are planning to get married may have to think again before saying, I do. Once they do get married, those with disabilities might lose their desperately needed benefits, raising the issue of marriage inequality. The cost burden on the shoulders of disabled Americans is so high that many rely on Social Security, disability insurance, supplemental security income, Medicare, Medicaid, welfare, and food stamps. If one loses these benefits, he or she might not even be able to pay for the cost of medication, physiotherapy, and other medical treatment. The disability marriage penalty refers to punishing people with disabilities who get married in the United States by taking away the much-needed benefits that they receive from the state or federal government. If a disabled person marries a non-disabled person, it is expected that he or she becomes the burden of the spouse and not the government anymore.
We have health care tied to marriage. That has a negative impact if you cannot access those things. We're talking about supplemental security income, which is called SSI, and sometimes SSDI, as well as Medicaid benefits. Those are the things that people would lose if they were disabled and then become married.
In New York State, where I'm at, the income threshold is like $68,000 if you're a single person and $92,000 if you are a married couple, as well as there are asset limits. So how much assets you can have in the household. And, you know, it goes into how many cars you can have, what is the value of the home that you have. So all these different things are added into that asset value. So that really is detrimental if you want to become married.
It is not just getting married that is the problem for disabled Americans. In some cases, if some were to make too much money according to the law, they would lose their Medicaid, which they're receiving to pay for the home health care program, which is one of the most important programs that keeps some of the disabled people alive. So essentially, in order to remain in different programs, the disabled have to keep living in poverty. What are some discriminatory laws that the disabled face in America today?
Some of the laws that are most egregious are the ones regarding marriage. Because having a disability, if you want to have a partner or a lifelong companion, it is almost impossible to still get benefits, as they call them, and have the ability to marry or to have any significant other in their life. The other barriers are to laws that are on the books regarding work, how much you can get paid, laws regarding where you can live, and who can and cannot make decisions for you. And so things around employment, guardianship, health care, transportation, the right to have your equipment fixed. So those are some of the laws and barriers that are faced in the United States.
In Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Kansas, Minnesota, and Michigan, people with intellectual disabilities, mental disabilities, and epilepsy were prevented from marrying due to several laws passed in the early 20th century. Other states also used legislation prohibiting anyone that was considered to have a genetic defect from getting married. Some of these laws are not enforced any longer, but have not been removed from the books. So what are the benefits the state and federal governments give people with disabilities?
In the U.S., people with disabilities, you know, if they apply for it, we get what's called Social Security Disability Income. So that's SSI and SSDI. And that's a monthly check that comes to people with disabilities if they apply for it. So that's a monthly check. It's close to like $800, $900, which, you know, sounds like a lot, but especially in big cities like New York City and here in California, rent is so high. You know, you have to pay a monthly rent. You know, for example, rent could be like $3,000 a month. So if you're getting only, you know, $800 to $1,000 a month, then you really, it's hard to pay rent. So yes, people with disabilities, once they apply for Social Security income, you know, sometimes you have to appeal and fight for it. But once you get it, you know, you get a monthly check every month.
The Disabled Adult Child, or DAC benefit, is a Social Security Administration disability benefit. Someone receiving a DAC benefit must be a dependent adult child that qualified for receiving it before the age of 22. The beneficiaries receive a monthly payment and Medicare. Many of the beneficiaries also qualify to receive Medicaid that covers personal attendant care and other devices and services that are not covered through private insurance.
There are cash benefits that would be known as Social Security Disability Income, or SSDI, and then Social Security Income, or SSI. If you're a veteran, you'll get a veteran's pension, possibly. You may get medical coverage through Medicaid or Medicare, or again, if you are a veteran, through VA. But these are probably some of the more common things you might receive. What would be called food stamps or food assistance. You may receive transportation assistance to get back and forth to your medical appointment. But those kind of resources or benefits are not necessarily guaranteed. And typically they depend on your income or your they depend on your ability to qualify for the program.
DAC recipients lose their monthly payments and their Medicare if they get married, and they may also lose their Medicaid. The only way that they will not lose their benefits is if the DAC recipient marries another person who is receiving Social Security Disability Insurance, or SSA, or someone who is receiving another secondary benefit. This means that essentially, a disabled person who does not want to lose his or her benefits must marry another disabled person who is also receiving benefits.
Marriage has always been really important to me, and yet I'm not able to get married because of my Medicaid.
Lucia, what do you want to watch?
I don't know, but we've got new stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Juan and I met online. Being with him has absolutely changed my life. I had a lot of negative self-talk of, nobody's ever going to want to be with you. Nobody's ever going to want to spend their life with you. You're such a burden.
Your wedding style is eclectic.
Oh, here's my boards that has everything on them. Our marriage plans right now are on hold because there is a marriage penalty to where if we get married, his income would make me no longer qualified to receive Medicaid. So all my caregivers, all my medical equipment, everything, I would not be able to have any of that anymore. To just pay for caregivers, it would be between $100,000 and $200,000 a year. Medicaid is the only type of insurance that would pay for this much care.
This is not the only challenge that the disabled face in America. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the unemployment rate for people with disabilities is more than double the rate of those without. A Journal of Occupational Rehabilitation survey asked human resource professionals and supervisors about their attitudes towards hiring and retaining workers with disabilities, and more than half of the respondents reported that the employers did not hire workers with disabilities because they felt they could not perform essential job functions. So is it only marriage that results in the cancellation of disability benefits?
No, it's not only marriage. It's, you know, if you make more than the amount, I think you can only have like $800 in the bank. So, you know, there's a program called SSI, and that's a program for people that never worked before. And there's a program that's called SSDI, and that's a program for people with disabilities that have worked. So SSDI, you can make a little bit more than SSI. But SSI, you can only have a certain amount in the bank. And if you go over that, you know, if you do have a job and you're collecting SSI, if you go over that, then they can cut you off.
According to research from Rivera and Andres Tilschik of the University of Toronto's Rotman School of Management, Discrimination against the disabled begins much before they actually enter the workforce. The discrimination starts when disabled students want to enter schools, and it affects their educational opportunities. The opportunities would be substantially worse if the disabled student is also Black.
If you are, you know, employed above and beyond what the rate is, a certain amount of hours a week or a month, you can lose your benefits, even though the money may not, the money may just get you to the point of being able to survive. Your assets, if you have more than anything that's valued over $5,000 or $6,000, that could lead you to having things lost in terms of your coverage, in terms of your health care, in terms of your housing. So it really is based upon, you know, it's nothing you can do really, other than you either have to get really rich and get out of having to need certain things from the government, or you just don't do it. And a lot of people are stuck with the second choice.
In the past, some municipal statutes were in place in the U.S. that outlawed the appearance in public of people who were, in the words of the Chicago City Code of 1881, diseased, maimed, mutilated, or in any way deformed so as to be an unsightly or disgusting object. These regulations were referred to as ugly laws. For the first time, such a law was introduced by the city of San Francisco in 1867 to prohibit street begging and to restrain certain persons from appearing in streets and public places.
From the 1860s and into the 20th century, many cities across the U.S. had so-called ugly laws. And if you're accused of violating them, then you could, in fact, be arrested for ugliness. But these codes weren't intended to judge people based on attractiveness, like a 19th century Tinder, but actually a method of legal discrimination designed to keep people who were differently abled, injured, destitute, or any combination of these categories off of the streets and out of sight. And although we think we've come a long way, the last case involving an ugly law was in 1974, only 16 years before the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law. Yikes. So, how did this all arise? Well, our first question needs to be, what are ugly laws and when were they first passed? In her book, The Ugly Laws, Disability in Public, Susan Schweik traces the earliest history of these laws in the U.S. to 1867, 2 years after the end of the Civil War. In San Francisco, a former Union soldier named Martin Oates was arrested and then written about in the San Francisco Morning Call, which reported him as a half-demented fellow named Martin Oates who had been stricken down with paralysis, leaving him a perfect wreck. Schweik then notes that Oates was arrested and taken into custody while San Francisco awaited the completion of its almshouse, or a place designed to charitably take in the poor and destitute. The law that was used to arrest Oates had been passed a few weeks earlier and called for people who were diseased, maimed, mutilated, or in any way deformed to be removed from the streets or to be otherwise kept from public view and prohibited from begging.
People with disability are dehumanized in the United States and probably in a lot of other countries around the world. They are dehumanized because their disability is used when referring to them, and like gender and race, disability is a core component of their identity. Administrative hurdles and obstacles also tend to hurt this community more than the non-disabled, since they need to go through difficult administrative procedures in order to receive the benefits they desperately need.
Being Black and disabled, A lot of discrimination is coming from police brutality of Black disabled people is high. It's almost 70% of all police abuses cases are disabled people, especially Black disabled people. So that's one thing, is police brutality. Another thing is discrimination in jobs, getting a job. Black disabled people have almost 90% unemployment rate. So you know, getting a job is hard for Black disabled people. And third is starting our own organizations as Black disabled people. A lot of people have tried to start organizations and have failed because of a lack of support and a lack of funding.
The Americans with Disabilities Act provides access to public accommodations for the disabled, but it does not prohibit the marriage penalty. Advocates are calling for new legislation, such as the Marriage Equality for Disabled Adults Act, that would remove the marriage penalty from federal law, but the bill is still sitting in the House of Representatives Subcommittee on Health since January 2022.
As a person with a disability, the problems that you will encounter almost immediately are suspension and or loss of those very same benefits that were described before. So your interview will lose the ability to receive your Social Security or SSDI payments, potentially your qualification for your housing, potentially your medical coverage. Any assets that you may have, depending on which state and how they are ranked, those are some of the things that are immediate when you are contemplating whether or not you want to get married as a person with a disability. And depending on your parental status at the time, there may be some challenges to your ability to keep your child. So those are some of the barriers you might face as a person with a disability trying to get married.
In a blow to the disabled community, the activist who led U.S. disability rights movement, Judith Heumann, died at the age of 75 in early March this year. She died a week after heart issues at a hospital in Washington, D.C. Doctors said that her heart issues might have been as a result of her lifelong challenge with polio. Heumann was born in Philadelphia in 1947, raised in New York, and contracted polio in 1949.
When I was 5 years old in Brooklyn, New York, on East 38th Street, my mother did what every other parent did when their kid was five. She took me to school to register me. And this was in the early 1950s. There were no motorized wheelchairs, so she pushed me to school, and it wasn't accessible. She pulled me up the steps, and the principal said I couldn't go to school because I was a fire hazard. I don't really know that there was an explanation. It just was. I think the average person, they see disability as a threat to not being able to do things as people have typically done them. And I think there's truth in that. But the question is it because one has a disability or because society itself has constructed itself in such a way because they haven't seen us? Discrimination against disabled people has existed from the beginning of time.
Judith Heumann co-founded an activist group called Disabled in Action and infamously led the longest sit-in at the federal building in U.S. history for 28 days to protest the U.S. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare's refusal to implement regulations from a section of the 1973 Rehabilitation Act.
21 years old, I was denied an elementary school teaching credential because of, quote, paralysis of both lower extremities, sequelae of poliomyelitis, end quote. At the time, I didn't know what sequelae meant. I went to the dictionary and looked it up and found out that it was because of. So it was obviously because of my disability that I was discriminated against. At the age of 25, I was told to leave a plane on my return trip to my job here in the U.S. Senate because I was flying without an attendant. In 1981, an attempt was made to forcibly remove me and another disabled friend from an auction house because we were, quote, disgusting to look at, end quote. In 1983, a manager at a movie theater attempted to keep my disabled friend and myself out of his theater because we could not transfer out of our wheelchairs. These are only a few examples of discrimination I have faced in my 40-year life. I successfully fought all of these attempted acts, be it aggressive confrontation or litigation. but this stigma scars for life.
The United States health system is extremely costly, discriminatory, and unjust. The combination of these factors, unemployment and receiving less pay than the non-disabled people, makes it twice as likely for disabled people to live below the poverty line. The procedure for disabled people to receive benefits is so complicated that legal industries have formed to help them apply for programs and appeal disability insurance decisions.
Big issue in America that people with disabilities have been fighting for, going back to the 70s and even 60s, trying to fight to get that legal language out of Social Security disability benefits, saying that if you get married to a person with a disability that he, she is on Social Security, then both of your Social Security can be cut. So because of that, a lot of people with disabilities don't get married, because, they, if they're on SSI, Social Security disability, then they don't want the risk of getting that cut. So a lot of times they don't get married. They just live together and don't get married. So that's a campaign that has been going on for decades to change that legal law in Social Security disabilities so people with disabilities can get married, So, yeah.
In a rich country like the United States, one might expect that some of the riches would be funneled towards those who need it most. People with disabilities that also live in poverty will have a very difficult challenge to secure a well-paying job, and even if some find employment, it will not be enough to cover the enormous medical costs they have to endure. Most U.S. politicians ignore the weakest in society, which makes you wish that the ugly laws would be brought back and implemented against the greedy, ugly-minded politicians.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Russia warns Kiev that using Western-supplied depleted uranium shells could leave serious negative impacts in Ukraine for decades and even centuries. Protests against the Israeli cabinet's controversial judicial reforms follow Prime Minister Netanyahu to London, where he has been met with UK, where he rather met his UK counterpart. North Korea says it has tested an underwater nuclear attack drone, which can unleash a radioactive tsunami to destroy enemies' naval vessels and ports. Hello and welcome, everybody. Russia's defense ministry has warned that the use of depleted uranium shells in Ukraine will harm Ukrainian troops, population, and even the agriculture sector for a long time. The ministry says the West is well aware of the negative impacts of the weapons on the population and environment. It cited the U.S. and NATO's use of depleted uranium in Iraq and the Balkans as an example. The ministry said uranium shells leave serious negative impacts. For decades and even centuries, the UK has declared plans to supply Ukrainian forces with ammunition equipped with depleted uranium. The ammo could help weapons penetrate tanks and armor more easily. The Kremlin has warned of a nuclear collision between Russia and the West if the UK goes ahead with the decision. Protests have been following Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to the UK capital, where he has been meeting his British counterpart Rishi Sunak. Protesters gathered outside No. 10 Downing Street in London amid intensifying anger over Netanyahu's proposed judicial reforms. The occupied territories have been rocked by protests for weeks over the controversial reforms. If approved by Parliament, the bill would weaken the Supreme Court and grant the ruling coalition more powers in appointing judges. Critics argued that the overhaul will foster corruption and bring about diplomatic isolation. The reforms have also drawn condemnation from Tel Aviv's allies such as the U.S. and Germany. Pro-Palestinians also gathered in London to vent their anger at the Israeli premier's visit to the UK. The protesters say Benjamin Netanyahu's trip will embolden the regime to continue its acts of aggression against Palestinians and expand its settlement activities.
What these protesters are saying here is that the UK government's decision to invite Netanyahu at a time like this to the UK is indeed a mark of approval of the far-right government, of the Israeli regime's aggression and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, that it will give Israel further cover for it to continue to steal and to annex more Palestinian territory and its aggressions against the Palestinian people. As I say, more than 100 Palestinians killed this year alone, since the beginning of this year alone, and the premiership of Rishi Sunak in number 10 Downing Street. They're also, as I mentioned earlier, asking for the UK to stop arming Israel. The UK, of course, being home to Elbit Systems, an Israeli weapons manufacturer, employing upwards of 600 people, and advertising its weapons as battle-tested, a reference to the fact that the weapons were used in the different wars against the people in Gaza, the largest open-air prison in the world over the years. And so what they're doing here is they're calling the British government out and telling the world that this is wrong, that this trip should have been canceled and not having been allowed to take place. He will, of course, be leaving the UK and visiting Berlin and the German officials there, where he is also expected to face the same opposition, the same kind of protest.
French trade unions have called for a new day of nationwide strikes and protests next Tuesday as anger mounts over the government's unpopular pension reforms. Trade union organizations made the announcement in a joint statement blaming the government for, quote, the explosive situation in the country. They also asked workers to continue protesting against President Emmanuel Macron's pension reforms. The statement came after over 1 million people took part in nationwide demonstrations in the ninth day of protests against Macron's plan. The massive protests were organized by unions and protested what they called Macron's scorn and lies. According to the French Interior Ministry, 123 law enforcement members were injured during clashes with protesters, 80 of whom were arrested. Riot police fired tear gas